The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 122, a panel discussion, Wish I Could Find a Book to Live In, Books That Have Enlarged My Religious Worldview, with panelist Edward L. Kimball, Mary Beth Raines, Ardeen Watts, chaired by Chrissy Benton. This is a one-hour panel discussion.
Good morning. I think it's time that we get started so that we allow for all the comments and papers we can get in. This is section 122, Wish I Could Find a Book to Live In, Books That Have Enlarged My Religious Worldview. And we're fortunate to have three panelists and many people in the audience that we hope will have a lot to say. I'm supposed to remind you that we're here by name tag or ticket only. We want the Sunstone Symposium to be financially successful. And that those of you who would like to will be able to get the tape after the session is over. Our three panelists will speak in the order that they are listed in the program, and then we hope to be able to have time for those of you in the audience to share your ideas as well. Our first speaker will be Ed Kimball. He is an emeritus professor of law from BYU. And I thought it was interesting that he lists on his bio that the associations and organizations he belongs to are too many, and the awards and recognitions he has received are too few. And he also lists among his accomplishments in life, his wife, Bea, and his seven children. Our second speaker is Mary Beth Raines. She is a licensed clinical social worker and a marriage and family therapist in private practice in Salt Lake City. She has three children and three spouses of those three children, surprisingly all wonderful. And she has three grandchildren whom she adores. And then our last speaker will be Ardeen Watts, who comes to us from Africa, and we'll hear more from him in session 316 about his adventures there. He's a professor emeritus of music from the University of Utah and former associate conductor of the Utah Symphony. Those of you who've been associated with Sunstone in the past know that all three of these people have been strong Sunstone supporters and participants over the years, and we're very excited to hear from all of them. So, Ed Kimball.
We're apparently each marching to a different drummer, having been either given or guessing at different instructions. I'd like to talk today about half a dozen different books or articles that were significant for me. Others will be more concentrated on single sources. This sort of thinking back over my life and points of significant reading. The first one that I remember is a juvenile novel by G.A. Henty in a series called The Young Colonists. This was a book about the Revolutionary War, but it was told from the point of view of two young fellows who were royalists, who were Tories. And somehow, in my teenage, when I read that, I suddenly realized that there was another side to the story of the Revolutionary War, and that by expansion, that there is another side to every story. And that one is fooling himself if he takes without consideration, without skepticism, any version of any story. And that it requires some effort on our part to get outside of the framework in which we are cast originally to try to see things afresh. I realized that had I been alive at the time, I probably would have been a Tory. And that hurts because I've always idolized the revolutionary heroes who brought freedom to this land, and yet I know enough about myself and my personality to realize that I might very well have been on the other side if I had lived in those days. And that was a welcome to the world of ambiguity. I think, and this almost embarrasses me, I can even understand terrorists killing innocent people. I hope I would not be inclined to do that, but I understand their Nephi quality that someone must die in order that a greater good come forth. It's a hard choice to be made, and I would choose not to make it, but I think I understand it. I used to serve on the Utah Board of Pardons and Paroles. I remember one time in a hearing in which a relative of the prisoner took the stand and said, I used to drive by this prison and say, why don't they just drop a bomb on this place? Wipe them out. He said, until my nephew came here. I knew him. I knew his heart. Sure, he made mistakes, but he's not a bad person who deserves to be destroyed. There's the old story about the judge who heard the plaintiff's explanation of the story, and he said, you're right. Then he heard the defense side of the story, and he said, you're right. Somebody said, they can't both be right. He said, you're right. Second book I'd mention is Juanita Brooks' Mountain Meadows Massacre. This was a wonderful experience for me in opening my eyes again to the kind of ambiguity. Here are good people, people who were not but could have been my ancestors, who killed in a horrendous massacre. Mormons are capable of atrocity, just like other people in other times and places. Good people can do monstrous things if they are given a sufficient rationale. But I think another lesson from the book is that secrets will finally out. That you can't hide bad things forever. They will come out. So you either don't do them or you face up to the mistakes that you have made. Those are really the only two choices. Leaders are not infallible. Those who killed in Mountain Meadows were under the leadership of state president who gave those instructions. So we're under the necessity of making decisions for ourselves, and I think we will sometimes at least, we'll find ourselves in a dead end, in a blind alley, where we wish we weren't, but don't know how to get out. I think that from that I learned the value of light and air in healing. It seems to me that if Juanita had not written that book, that we might still be sort of denying it, knowing it was true and yet somehow explaining it away. And yet, once the story is out and you say, yes, we did it and we're sorry, then forgiveness can come from the other side. It's a kind of repentance, a kind of catharsis, and you can begin to forgive yourself. When I think of the way she describes the cloud of gloom that was over Dixie, southern Utah, for a generation, because there were things people didn't or couldn't talk about. I think there was guilt that passed down from parents to children. That finally, once we hear the whole story, we don't like it. But at least we begin to understand, and we then can move on. A third book is in my field of law. It's a book called Arrest by Wayne LaFave. It won't mean anything to any of you, but it was interesting to me because for the first time in analysis of law, somebody articulated the idea that there is discretion in the legal system and that it is irrepressible. That means, for example, if the legislature says police must arrest everybody who is involved in child abuse, let's say, or spouse abuse, and yet it's a case that doesn't really fit the model because it's not, there are explanations that make it less serious than it would otherwise be. The police may arrest, but then somebody else will exercise the discretion. The prosecutor will refuse to prosecute or will prosecute for lesser crime, or the jury will refuse to convict. If I can try to transfer that to religion, to church, there are some things that will have their effect, and it doesn't do any good to say they won't, because we have not the power of control just by saying so or by discipline. I guess one example that comes to mind is birth control. I think it doesn't matter what was said over the pulpit. Mormons did exercise control of procreation. And so then when it is part of our accepted pattern, then we get a reinterpretation of principles. The principle is family is good. The application is how many, what means. If an institution gets too far ahead of or behind the people, it's going to operate under a handicap. It may survive, but it'll be under stress. Let me go on then. Jack Welch, articles on chiasmus in the Book of Mormon. You know, there's so many aspects of the Book of Mormon you can argue about, horses and how many millions of people there could have been in such and such amount of time, like the 2 million Israelites that were wandering in the desert for 40 years. You know, numbers to me in that context are not to be taken seriously. But my point about chiasmus is that strikes me as one of the most powerful evidences for the Book of Mormon's being what it's said to be. It's an interesting literary form. You'll know about it, I'm sure, already. But it seems to me that it is evidence that the author of that book took great pains and a great amount of time to construct it in a very complex way, because the book is full of chiasmus. And I don't think Joseph Smith could have done it. And if he could have done it, he would not have failed to point it out. However subtly, he would have seen that it was discovered, because he'd have said, I have hidden in this text a powerful proof of its authenticity. And the fact that neither he nor any of his followers recognized this incredibly complex formulation of the text is to me, at this point, one of the most powerful evidences from the Book of Mormon that comes outside of the spiritual testimony. Lester Bush's article on the background of the policy on restrictions on race, on priesthood for those of Negroid race, was very important to me, because while I had, of course, the feelings of wanting that restriction to be lifted, I did it sort of in the face of a concern about the scriptural basis for it, the historic basis for it. And Lester Bush's careful work enabled me as a younger man to see the policy as one based on history more and interpretation than on anything that I felt a need to conform to accept fully, that it was more likely Brigham Young than Joseph Smith, who was the initiator of it, that the scriptural passages that seem to fit so neatly if you already know the answer and then work backwards to find out how do we get to that answer, that those, if you start from the other end and start from the scriptures themselves, don't at all lead inexorably to the end to which they were turned by people who were seeking to justify what I think ultimately is justifiable. One last one, and then I'll yield the podium, is a book by George P. Lee, Silent Courage. It's the story of his life as a young boy on the reservation in the Indian Student Placement Program of the church, and then his later career as an educator and as a general authority. The part of it that struck me forcibly was a sense that you could be Indian in the deepest sense and a Mormon, and that the two are not incompatible. It isn't two strange cultures that are fighting one another, but they're two different cultures that can exist in the same person, and I'd like it if they existed in me the way that they do. Let me read a couple of paragraphs from his book that suggest the way he perceived it. This is something his father told him, and he's reporting it to us. My son, never believe that these mountains cannot listen to you, for they're alive. If you watch them a long time, you can see that they also have movement. They're sacred. That's why they reach into the heavens. A man may grow close to his Creator up here. As the winds pass through the trees that adorn the mountains, they whisper messages to which all nature listens. You may hear these things if you can be calm enough inside. This nature's not illusion, but often what man does is. You're a part of nature too. Learn to be quiet inside and listen. This way you will always be filled with peace and beauty, for Mother Earth will bring her best forward just for you. Another passage, an Indian's understanding is that we are here to assist the Great Spirit. to look after and take care of his creations, no matter what they may be, animal or plant. This is the Indian's idea of having dominion over the living things of the earth. Because of my father's love for animals, he had no fear of them. Well, there are many other books that I could mention, but these are some that gave me, as an individual, new insights, new courage to do some of the things that might otherwise have been difficult.
I made up a number of specific notes, so Ardeen, if you would simply hold your hand up to flag me down at the 12 or 15 minute mark, it will help. I want to say two introductory comments. First is, I have changed the title from religious worldview to spiritual worldview, given for me now that's a more encompassing subject in terms of what I've experienced. And secondly, I'd like to talk about, just briefly, the process of reading as enlarging my spiritual worldview. That reading of all sorts is not only important, but I think it's probably one of the few free lunches I've had in life. And most people who are real readers actually love the process of reading as much as prayer or scriptures or traveling, which I'll get to, or any other thing in life, and that there are whole parts of your life organized around getting books and keeping them, and ones you're going to read and ones that are in the bathroom and ones that you'll have lent and haven't got back and the ones your library finds on. And your life is organized around this enlarging of self. In addition, I love traveling. My first traveling, of course, was by reading. And my inner world, as I found out about other places, I lived in a little coastal town in Oregon. The first significant traveling occurred when I went to Austria on my mission, and then I was hooked and still travel all over. And I think the core part of it is I love the seeking, even though not always wonderful. I love new experiences, new explanations, but most of all, I love the big picture. I want to know what the big, ultimate picture is. In the search for the big picture, I have grown to love maps. I searched the Atlas as a kid. On road trips, I loved pulling out the too big road map into my lap and translating the sights around me into the marks and symbols that were on the map. The exercises of measuring distance, finding the relationships between locations, even running my finger over the colors and trying to decide which trees and which lakes and which plains they matched were important. Maps are now in my inner visual world, holding the world image, this big picture, in view. So even though the map is not the territory, it marks the spot where I can find my treasures of experience from the past and has mental post-it notes on every one about what I want to do and experience in the future. How does this relate to reading that enlarges me spiritually? The common thread is that I'm interested in the big picture. And as much as I'm interested in the big picture of the world and where I can go in it, I'm interested in the map or the big picture of the spiritual world. About 20 years ago, I experienced a large crisis of faith and have been coming to Sunstone ever since. and it occurred simultaneously in one summer, actually this month, 20 ago, in which I was reading the New Mormon History. At the same time, I was reading several books on mysticism from several other religions. And as you might imagine, my old map, I suddenly discovered, was instead of this big and taking my whole lap, was maybe this big. And that there were all kinds of other experiences, some trustable, some not, that I didn't know about. As I read further and discussed these new worlds with friends, I started seeing many facets to a larger spiritual world, but I did not see a new picture on the box. I did not see a map. So I have been delighted, puzzled, and slowly more enlightened as I have found writers who have been constructing this larger map of the spiritual world, the inner world of our spiritual consciousness and connection with God, with, indeed, references to the places in the outer world where these different pieces of the map have come from. I'm now getting the same experience in my spiritual world that I have had from the maps of my physical world. Let me briefly introduce the two writers, essentially, instead of books, that I'm going to talk about, by giving a historical approach. As the geographic world was opening up to explorers in the last two centuries, so was the spiritual world. In this same time frame, spiritual anthropologists of sorts started journeying throughout the globe and entered into years, even decades, of training in all of the mystical traditions of the religions of the world And mystical traditions, I might note, are those that are interested in direct communion and experience with God. They're not as focused on esoteric practices as much as they are finding ways to the direct experience in communion with God, which has always enticed me. And when I started having spiritual experiences very young and spontaneously as a child. They then wrote about their training and personal experiences. They recorded the doctrines, ceremonies, which they found. They translated sacred and ancient texts and brought back their discoveries. Also, highly trained spiritual teachers from all over the world's major traditions gradually started coming to Europe and America shortly thereafter. This spiritual interchange started very slowly and sporadically, but has built steadily and continuously over the last century. Within the last 30 years, for the first time in history, texts from all the sacred traditions have been available to the general public in the West. In these last three decades, writers who have both intellectually and experientially explored different traditions have started in at least two ways to explore this knowledge and make it more accessible to the intellectually curious or spiritual practitioner. First, these people have started to translate the teaching and techniques, esoteric traditions or mystical traditions, into language and strategies that the Western mind can use in everyday life. No special language skills are required, leaving one's everyday life is not necessary. These writers have tried to find ways to help us transform our lives by integrating the salient spiritual practices and principles from all the world's traditions. Second, and these are the ones I want to focus on, another group of writers have sought to integrate the various traditions into some sort of comprehensive synthesis that includes all the essentials of each tradition into a larger spiritual map. Just as cartographers have gradually created a detailed, accurate map of the entire globe, as far as we know. Additionally, these spiritual cartographers have tried to give more than just a simple map of the territory. They have constructed a comparative map of how spiritual growth occurs in essentially the same stages from one spiritual tradition to another, and they have integrated it with the work of Western developmental psychology and philosophy, the hard and the soft sciences. These overarching models presented by these authors is that the many forms of knowing can be systematically arranged into stages to form a continuous spectrum from how humans grow, even from being a neonate, to the neonate level of awareness to the highest known, often exemplified by various stages, including sages, including Christ. So let me introduce you to two seers who are constructing this large Rosetta Stone for our comprehension of the larger map of spiritual consciousness. Neither is inspirational in tone or has a gospel to preach in the traditional sense. Neither advocates one spiritual road over another. Both are integrative thinkers in the world of transpersonal psychology, a newly emerging discipline, some would dispute this, but bear with me, that seeks to not only integrate all the major spiritual and philosophical views of the world into comprehensive models of experience and understanding that we moderns can make sense of, and to do so in ways that include scientific evidence and practical reality. Both are seasoned in inquiry thought. Interestingly, neither is employed by academia. Both are self-employed seers at large, if you will. The first is Ken Wilber, who has written at least 10 to 12 books, and his whole map is with you to two books to get a start. The most easy to read is A Brief History of Everything, which is his Reader's Digest version of Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality, The Spirit of Evolution. Sex is really reads gender. It is not about sex, actually, as such. Or sexual experience. After 20 years of study, he has assigned himself the task to integrate and include all of the fundamental tenets of the sciences, philosophies, religion, history, literature, cultural psychology, and other forms of inquiry by reconceptualizing the whole, as A Brief History implies. I think he has quite simply a stunning ability to integrate more disparate forms of thought than almost anyone else I have read, although certainly not all agree with him. His scheme makes brilliant, but certainly not simple sense. Houston Smith, famous over many decades for making the world's religions understandable to the American mind, says, Ken Wilber has done more than even Carl Jung to describe and enlarge our understanding of the large spiritual world of a larger consciousness. So I've heard. Let me just give you two or three insights of Wilber, and then I'll go on to my second one. First of all, a map of this developmental process is absolutely necessary. Essentially, spirit enlarges within us, and we enlarge within it in stages. And we know that from developmental psychology, but it happens in the spiritual sense also. He has mapped out 9 stages in roughly 3 major phases. So, I didn't bring a map, but in any case, the first one is called prepersonal, meaning the stages of growth before you become a person, meaning you have a separate sense of self. It's those early stages of childhood when you're learning you have a separate body, you have a separate mind, you have separate emotions, and you're trying to stabilize the whole in a way to make the world work, which my grandchildren are trying to do right now. The second major phase, and the 4th, 5th, and 6th stages, are those of most adults walking around every day who have reached the stage in which they know another person is another person who has their own rights and responsibilities separate from your own. And at the more mature stages of growth, you even know at every act and every thought that the other person's thoughts and wisdom and experience is just as important to them as yours is to you, and has some validity that's equally certain as yours is to you. And then the last 3 stages that go into the 3rd phase are called transpersonal, and that's the reason for transpersonal psychology, meaning when one develops spiritually or developmentally or even socially and emotionally beyond just one sense of a separate self. Transpersonal means beyond the personal. But he makes an important clarification, which is anything you move through, you have to include and integrate. You don't dissociate and shut it off, except when it's a more limited form, which I'll get to. So that transpersonal, people in transpersonal stages really see all of us as one or part of the same larger field of consciousness and spirituality. And we also can still walk around in our own bodies. Essentially, we live in a big city and we have our own cars that we drive around, and yet we know how we're connected to the whole. Our ego identity is no longer located just in our separate self. It's located in a larger self. His map makes important sense. It gives a way to sort, to make a sense of the multitude of lists of wisdom and truth lying around in every corner of the world. And really important that it gives a meaningful progression that does not deny one truth to illuminate another. For example, a bottle is as necessary as a cup in a child's development. Each is appropriate to its stage. Neither is right or wrong. Similarly, religious and spiritual teachings are not absolutely right or wrong in the usual sense. The best ones fit in all stages and are adaptable to the particular requirements of a given stage, i.e., bottles or cups as needed. The poorer ones may allow enough liquid through for one stage, but do not allow enough at a later one, and may even hinder the quenching of the thirst for meaning, love, or the spirit at later times in life. It also gives sequence. It shows the skeleton of deep structure. What are the meaningful practices that actually tie one to the spirit through all of the stages versus those that are necessarily only as a training device? Like printing is useful for one stage, and then writing is another, crawling and then walking as we move through stages. Indeed, this idea of stages implicit in 2 well-known scriptures, line upon line, and Christ grew in knowledge and wisdom. These and others give the big picture, an idealized image of heaven or perfection from particular cultures, such as Mormon culture or from scriptures. To get there, we are enjoined to many spiritual practices. We are told what to do and how to do it, and spirituality or connection with God will occur. But the ladder of steps from here to there has not been well explicated enough, and a good map that I think is being constructed will suggest the rungs. One further insight from Wilbur that I think makes important sense is that spiritual maturity occurs only slowly, and you have to go through every stage. You can't jump around it. You can't go to stage 6 or 7 or 9 by not going through 3, 4, or 5, which means that you have to go through reason and doubt in order to get to full level of spiritual maturity. Reason is a stage in his map of spiritual experience, and doubt is one of the tools to be used during this stage. Moreover, once reason and doubt are learned as tools for discovering truth, they must thereafter be consistently employed. For example, it is necessary to use doubt and reason to learn to discriminate between mythological belief and principle of ethics and true spirituality. The small, ethnocentric, exclusive, and possibly punitive parts of a particular creed or belief in God must be sorted out from the more expansive, life-yielding principles of compassion, honesty, and ethical action toward others in order to grow into a larger vision of life with the Spirit. And, this is also important, in the stages after doubt and reason, the spiritual journeyer must learn how faith, reason, and action are all complementary to each other, not antithetical. Indeed, the searcher must transcend his or her trust in reasoning and doubting as the highest stage, the absolute. The next step is to learn to keep the elements of reason that yield to larger, more inclusive truths that include all the best tools of a spiritual journey and not exclude it. My second seer of choice is a woman named Jenny Wade, who has written one book called Changes of Mind. It has a large sub-whatever, but just go with Changes of Mind. You'll have to order it if you want to. It's not commonly found in the bookstores. There is no simple introduction to her. Lacking a Urim and Thummim for this book, to read her graduate level of psychological research language, get a dictionary. Skip the first chapter, start with the second chapter. The first chapter she spends trying her thesis to all of philosophical systems in the world. Unless you're a philosophy major, don't, you know, pick it up last. Her only book, which is probably her doctoral dissertation, covers much smaller terrain than Wilbur's, but with more depth. For someone such as myself, who wants the integration of psychological and spiritual growth more thoroughly explored, with notes about how the brain functions at each stage, how women theorists view growth, along with succinct tables to synopsize it all, Wade is a must-read. Indeed, all those who have encouraged to read her work, wheedle might be actually a more accurate term, have related staying up too late or canceling a meeting to keep reading. The reading is dense, but the information is amazing. You may disagree with parts of what she asserts, but she presents a framework well worth exploring. Two or three quick insights. At each stage of growth, and she has nine stages also, they're not quite the same as Wilbur's, but they're integrated, which says more and more writers starting to see this substrate of stages similarly. At each stage of growth, from the most primitive awareness to the most realized state, the brain functions differently. With each successive stage, more capacity is reached by first utilizing more parts of the brain, then by coordinating them fully, and finally by training them until they are all fully synchronous with each other. In the end, the different parts of the brain do not conflict with each other, but are in full concert. This means that in order to reach the next stage of spiritual growth, you must acquire more neurological capacity, not just more facts or more skills in the areas already well trained into your life. Also, after stage of learning of social conformity comes a bifurcated path. Many times in personality theory, men's theories and women's theories come into conflict, and they fight with each other, each, of course, stating that theirs is the highest, right? Her insight is that, no, they are the same. They require the same level of brain skills, complex reasoning, problem solving, and that in that level of personal development, those middle three stages, they're just bifurcated paths, one focusing on achievement and the other on relationships. But in order to get to the more transcendent or transpersonal stages, you have to learn both. So you don't get out of here without learning at all, essentially. And thirdly, the basic worldview of, or that is, core assumption of each developmental stage includes a paradox or problem that can only be really solved at the next stage. For instance, at the social conformity stage, the first stage of the three personal stages, for example, seeing the world as essentially fair and just is very important. Of the course, however, the world will never yield perfect fairness and justice, so this creates all sorts of problems for the person at this stage, as it should. To solve the problem, one must transcend it and see that ultimate fairness in the practical world does not exist, and that you can find ways of seeing life as unfair, yet creating limited fairness in your life and still live well. What these two writers give operating independently have and what they have offered is a fundamental map of the spectrum of human consciousness and of the spirit. They both say that these are the same. Though both assert with detailed documentation that this consciousness is our awareness and is not located solely in our body or our brain, and that, although always present and perfect, as most mystical texts state, our consciousness unfolds in predictable patterns from inception to fruition. So I have fallen in love with these writers, even though they're not inspirational in the usual sense. And so I'm bringing this back for the moment at the end to Mormonism, and to my own Mormon self, even though I've read many other places. Most Mormons, as do I, love information. We love insights. But the information we love most is the information that will be practical in the end. The question always rises, what is the practical use of all of this? Good question indeed. I have found that the details of a spiritual map not only is practical by listing stages, but that for each stage you can give variables of spiritual growth, and I'll give three that are important for Mormons. The view of God and connection with God will be fundamentally different at every stage, and each stage has to include the view of the other as you go along in a cruel fashion. Or love or service to others can be each mapped out differently so that service to another at the primary stage, for instance, pre-personal, looks like an act you do because you're told and that makes you a good person. At a reasonable, rational stage of personhood, that the gift of service is that it's a reciprocal process that occurs in which you give at times, which you're also given to at times, and the whole grows larger and larger. In the spiritual of the world, in the spiritual or transpersonal stages, service is seen as giving to yourself and to others because you are all one, that it just generates more fertilizer in the whole process of growth, not just to you, not just to the person that you're giving to, but to the whole world. So that you're in that inner matrix or intermatrix of how we're all connected to each other, that service then enlarges it all. Much like sunshine doesn't differentiate person to person, enlarges us all. So, after looking at this whole terrain, I feel like, actually, I have a place to come home again after leaving it. I realize that there is no way to go home in the old way. I can visit, but I can't go there entirely. I can't go back to the worldview I saw 20 years ago. And even though it is not the old home now, however, this new home has a lot of the same rooms. This larger home brings even more spiritual life to me, and the wonderful news that to get there, every gift, skill, and faculty of my mind that I have ever learned must be taken with me. Much as C.S. Lewis said, I am surprised by joy.
After hearing both of my predecessors, I really feel what I have to say is very flippant. And what I'm offering in this session is not indeed one of the thousands of books that I might put on the table. It is scarcely a book at all. In fact, I will and can read most of the text to you in the next 5 minutes. As powerful as its content is, the story of how we came to have this text in the first place is the real reason why it qualifies as having enlarged my religious worldview. Brother Kimball read a few lines from Brother Lee's biography. There will certainly be an obvious resonance. This is from 1854, Chief Seattle. The president in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. But how can you buy or sell the sky, the land? The idea is strange to us if we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the world, of the water. How can you buy them? Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Each shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every meadow, every humming insect, all are holy in the memory and experience of my people. We know the sap which courses through the trees as we know the blood that courses through our veins. We are part of the earth, and it is part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters. The bear, the deer, the great bees are our brothers. The rocky crests, the juices in the meadows, the body heat of the pony, and man all belong to the same family. The shining water that moves in the streams and the rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. The water's murmur is the voice of our father's father. The rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst. They carry our canoes and feed our children. So you must give to the rivers the kindness you would give to any brother. If we sell you our land, remember that the air is precious to us, that the air shares its spirit with all the life it supports. The wind that gave our grandfather his first breath also received his last sigh. The wind also gives our children the spirit of life. So if we sell you our land, you must keep it apart and sacred as a place where man can go to taste the wind that is sweetened by the meadow's flowers. Will you teach your children what we have taught our children, that the earth is our mother? What befalls the earth befalls all the sons and daughters of the earth. This we know, the earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. All things are connected like the blood that unites us all. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever to the web, he does to himself. One thing we know, our God is your God. The earth is precious to him, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt on its creator. Your destiny is a mystery to us. What will happen when the buffalo are all slaughtered, the wild horses tamed? What will happen when the sacred corners of the forest are heavy with a scent of many men and the view of the ripe hills is blotted by talking wires? Where will the thicket be? Gone. Where will the eagle be? Gone. And what is it to say goodbye to the swift pony and the hunt? The end of living and the beginning of survival. When the last red man has vanished from his wilderness, memory is only the shadow of a cloud moving across the prairie. Will these shores and forests still be here? Will there be any of the spirit of my people left? We love this earth as a newborn loves its mother's heartbeat. So if we sell you our land, love it as we have loved it. Care for it as we have cared for it. Hold it in your mind. Hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you receive it. Preserve the land for all children and love it as God loves us all. As we are part of the land, you too are part of the land. The earth is precious to us. It is also precious to you. One thing we know, there is only one God. No man, be he red or white, can be apart. We are brothers after all. I will be quoting extensively in the next moment or two from a book entitled Answering Chief Seattle by Albert Furtwängler, University of Washington Press, 1997. I happened to do considerable research on this speech a few years ago in connection. Traced most of the extant versions of this speech to four sources. The speech was given in 1854 on the occasion of Governor Stevens' proposal for a treaty which would cede land held by the Suquamish tribe to the Washington Territory. Dr. Henry A. Smith, a linguist, was present on that occasion and translated the speech that he was hearing into notes in English. The account of the speech was never printed until October 1887, that is, more than 30 years later, when it appeared as the 10th installment
in a column entitled Early Reminiscences, Scraps from a Diary in the Seattle Sunday Star. Three additional versions of the speech are known widely even today. I should say it is more widely known today than ever before. In an 1869 translation made by William Arrowsmith from Smith's Victorian language into modern English. And then a new speech based on Arrowsmith's but freely composed by Ted Perry in 1970 for an ecological film script, which indeed was commissioned by the Southern Baptist Church. Then there is a fourth version, an adaptation of Perry's speech made into an inscription at the Spokane World's Fair in 1974. The version I just read is the best known one, Ted Perry's script for a television film entitled Home, which I have never seen. But I have talked to Mr. Perry on the telephone about his role in producing that script. Smith, the guy that originally wrote the notes, states directly that this version is an imperfect rendering of a speech he heard through translation some 33 years or more before he put it into print. It is therefore, from this book, at best a faint echo of Chief Seattle's words, or at worst an account woven from faulty memory, imperfect notes, or pure fabulation. To the historian, it presents an intriguing example of how a story or an idea can persist in the face of overwhelming evidence that should demolish it. To the student of literature, it presents a no less sobering instance of the exalting and dissemination of a very suspicious text. According to Furtwängler, Arrowsmith's account of the speech, on which the one I read is based, is glaringly inaccurate and inconsistent, and he freely distorted or denied information in the original Smith's notes. Perry claims Arrowsmith's reading of the speech at the first Earth Day observance in 1970 as his source of inspiration, and publicly protested that he, and not Seattle, was the author of this version at the time that it was illustrated by Susan Jeffers and turned into a best-selling children's book, Brother Eagle, Sister Sky. Approximately the same text, and many of you probably have this in your homes as I did, quite by accident. I didn't buy it. His version must be considered, therefore, according to Furtwängler, a misleading corruption of a text, yet a brilliant, modern testament. The text of the speech is therefore valid, but the claim that Chief Seattle was its author is entirely spurious. Kaiser, the guy who delineated the four major sources about 20 years ago, said, "Whoever wrote these words, they constitute an impressive piece of writing. It is easy to see that such words may well function as mythical or religious statement." End of quote. In my study at home, there are approximately 2,000 books. I consider a significant number of them valuable for wisdom, instruction, and inspiration, every bit as much as books which have been designated as scripture by institutional authority. The parallels between the story that I have just told of the clouded history of Seattle's speech and books that are scripture to millions of people, billions, throughout the world is so obvious as to make further commentary superfluous. My study of Chief Seattle's speech over a period of 2 decades has contributed materially to my rejection of any category of writing so authoritative that it becomes normative for all people. Thank you.
I know you'd all like to thank our three presenters for the insights that they've shared with us and the obvious amount of work that they've put into getting their thoughts together. We want to hear from those of you who'd like to make comments or ask questions. And since people will be listening to this tape even more than are here today, could you come to the front to do that? Does anyone have a work that they'd like to also talk about that's influenced their spirituality?
I've been read the name of Jenny Wade's book or books.
It's one book, and it's
called Changes of Mind. It's State University of New York Press. I don't know the ISBN number offhand. It was 1966 or 1967. Probably 1966 is when it was published. You can find it easily on Amazon.com.
I've discovered. Does this work?
No.
Oh, we can pass the mic.
I just had a question. For our second speaker, Mary Beth Rains.
Yeah. I had a question for Mary Beth Rains. And you talked of the larger map, and I like that idea very much, that the map that you had been used to started shrinking. And I don't know if I mistook your overall picture, but I did not hear anything about Eastern spiritual philosophies. You talked of synthesizing Western, and that phrase caught my mind.
I'm glad you asked that. Let me go up to the regular mic. I'm glad you asked that because I wouldn't want to give any illusion about that. Absolutely not. This larger map includes Hinduism, Buddhism, Sufism, Confucianism, in Buddhism, all forms of Buddhism. So it includes all of that. So I'm simply meant that Judaism also, as well as Christianity, and as well as indigenous religions. So it's as wide a map as we can pull from. What I meant to say is that those have been translated into texts or books that we Americans or English speakers can easily understand, because the texts from many other cultures, just as our texts to other people, are quite obtuse and not understandable. So thanks for asking the question.
Ed, there was another historical novel that I encountered in my which did the same thing for me regarding the position of royalists and Tories. It was by Owen Wister, and I'm trying to remember the title. It was something like The Rebel or...
Virginia.
That's not it. It's something else. Maybe I've mistaken the author. But it was on that order. That's all I can say. Disturbing and enlightening.
I've read the brief history. I've read that, Mary Beth, and I'm attracted to these kind of books also, but I see it as kind of a weakness in me, and I wanted to ask you. I like those big pictures that you're describing, but every time I see the big map, you know, that tries to account for that stuff, I get jittery, I get nervous, and it's hard for me to take seriously this map-making effort. I don't know if I'm using that analogy correctly, but these big theories that try to explain all these important questions that we really care about, I have a hard time really feeling close to and resonating to.
It's yeah.
So that's I guess that's the dilemma.
Oh, no, actually, it's a great question.
I care about these questions, but every time I look for the big answer, I have a hard time seeing it.
Well, that's a great question. And my response is that the big question, the big answers to the big questions are often so abstract, we don't have a way to translate it back down into our concrete connection to reality. And that for most of us, we are in the personal stages, and concrete reality is very important. And things of the spirit or the larger must somehow be translated into what we currently experience, because it's by experience and feeling and feeling connected to reason that we shift and grow and change. That's why every spiritual tradition that teaches larger abstract truths has very strict disciplines of how you eat, who you talk to, who you don't, who, you know, everyone has it. And so by just reading it all, you're right, we don't have a way to connect with it. My experience has been, given that I love theoretical stuff and map making, is that I have taken all these little things that he speaks about, for instance, or Jenny Wade speaks about, and made a large grid. So I take each of the stages and then put the variables down on the side, and then try to plug them in, not just to what the concept is, but what my own experience of it is, or what maybe other people's experience it is. Truly, I have this piece of paper that's sort of like this at this point, including things that are not mentioned in their text that I'm obsessed with. For instance, relationship skills and how people treat each other, and what the view of love or sexuality or people who are less developed spiritually or cognitively, yet still part of the whole. So that's my own translation work, as much as people who have heard Chief Seattle's speech, if it existed, or say the poet Rumi or the Sufi poets, have done a present modern day interpretation that is spiritual and heart lifting in view, but it is not a clear word for word translation of the original text. So,
excuse me. It occurred to me that in my zeal to put a bold face question mark at the end of my presentation, I may have omitted the punchline. I love every word of Chief Seattle's speech. That is as good as it gets to me. But not because he said it, because we don't know who said it. Or if it was written as an entirely commercial endeavor, which it was, by Ted, or by an author whose name is unknown to all of you, it makes no difference. It rises and falls on its content, not on its authority.
Mary Beth, I think a book I wanted to mention that I think you actually suggested to me, so probably way down your thinking, it was helpful along these lines, was not our Carol Lynn Pearson, but Carol Pearson's A Hero Within. I think that was the name of it.
Yeah, I think The Hero Within. It talks about different archetypes.
Yeah, a couple of interesting concepts there to me, because I think the book also has a number of serious problems. But she introduces, instead of a linear path in a Mormon mind, a circular path in development that you keep that you keep coming up with the same things but at deeper levels, with the symbolism going, the journey inside. And secondly, she took a lot of the judgment out of being stuck in a developmental sequence until seeing it more that you're learning certain lessons within that developmental stage. And so I really quite like The Hero Within.
The Hero Within I like too. Actually, she's right that we move in a circular or circuitous fashion as well as linear, and there are two images that come to mind, a way of expressing that. Remember those drinking cups, those collapsible cups you took camping? Well, if you open it up, you see the bottom stage is the neonate young stage, and as you grow, you keep getting larger and wider, but you have to include the previous in order to hold it all. Another is a circular staircase that is like a medieval tower, and it has windows at every place. And as you go through a stage, you come around in a circle, and as you start the next stage, you see the same view but from a different angle. so that as you are up at stage 6 or 7, you're still looking at the same view, but from such a different angle you can see all the nearby landscape as well as where you were before.
Mary Beth, could you comment on the relationship of the ideas of Wilbur and Wade with Lawrence Kohlberg in his stages of moral development?
Yes. Lawrence Kohlberg's stages of moral development would be essentially stage 1 through 6 of their 9 stages, and they roughly correlate. In fact, I think it's in the Brief History of Everything, Ken Wilbur has a chart in which he takes his stages and lines them up with Kohlberg and several other theorists. In fact, he has another chart which then lines it up with all the other major mystical traditions of the world and how those go. And I've sort of attempted one myself to see where some end before they end and where some don't start until later. And one of the ideas is that many mystical schools and traditions only start their map of successive stages of spiritual growth after we already end in number 6 for most of us. And so the two kind of conjoin then. And previously we've seen them as arguing with each other, but this is a continuous way to express it.
Unfortunately, it looks like we're out of time, so I want to encourage those of you to continue on with this discussion and know that you'd all like to thank our presenters one last time before we leave.